Welcome to Embracing the Muse. I'm your host, Sally Jean Fox, the author of Meeting the Muse After Midlife. And I'm on a quest to discover and understand how we can live our richest, most meaningful, and creative lives at any age, and especially as we age. And I'll be interviewing island creatives to discover what they can share with us about the highs and lows, ups and downs, and possibilities of living and sustaining a creative life. Well, I have a super opportunity today to interview three of the members of the Rising Waters Collective. And I am so excited to learn about what they're doing because they have classical music backgrounds that they're bringing out to the world in a very different way. And in particular, they're staging an event on October 11th in just a few weeks, which is going to be a one-day immersive opera experience featuring six distinct interpretations of the same work performed by local artists from different backgrounds, cultural identities, ages, and voice types. From a historic church to an intimate storefront to digital screens, each performance reframes la voix humaine through a unique creative lens. So just starting out, this is like so uber cool because when I think of classical music, and I love classical music, there's always a certain sense of either elitism or a little bit of distance from the public. But the values of your collective seem very much integrated with social change, diversity, inclusion, really breaking out of the box, and also performing in places where probably opera hasn't been heard before. Here, let me tell you who's here with me right now. I have Julie Benzinger, who is a director of the project and also was one of the co-founders. She lives on Bainbridge when not in Spain, yeah, which is very cool. But she's also right here, right now, and directing, helping to direct this upcoming event. I also have Lucy Weber, who's a co-director and a genuine Vashonite. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I have Corlin Simmons, who is also a Vashonite and also a singer, right?
Yes, correct.
Right. So I am so lucky to have the three of you together. Let me take us back a little bit because, again, this idea of opera mixed with social change, or I don't know if you define it as opera or chamber or, you know, how you're working with it, but that is not an everyday mix. Can you talk to me about how that came about and how you got inspired?
So it actually started in a road trip with myself and EB. EB and I were on a road trip to Idaho to go audition for Opera Idaho.
Let's just say who EB is.
EB is one of our co-creators. And this was all just like an eight-hour conversation between here and Boise on what we want an opera company to look like and our fantasy of if we could create an opera company, what would we do and what does it look like? And, you know, we love the singers who live here. We want them to have opportunities. We want them to have ability to hone their craft and to get paid for all of the time that they've spent learning and working on their voices. And so we finished our road trip. We came home and I didn't talk to her for a few days. And she texted me. She said, "Oh my gosh, okay, Julia Benzinger wants to be in on this too." And all of a sudden it became a company.
Wow.
And then I brought on Holly Boaz because she and I had also had deep conversations about what kind of opera company we wanted. And I really believe that there needs to be conversations around the works that we do. And I think opera should really integrate into communities. Julie lives in Spain, so she's really familiar with how important classical music is to the cities and towns and the cultures there. I was able to live in Austria for a summer, and it's very common to just have classical concerts on the streets and to have many little regional companies performing new works or traditional works in ways that feel really comfortable and they're not separated from people. And so I thought, you know, we want to be more embedded in the community in a way that doesn't put up any barriers, where people feel comfortable going, where it's not an intimidating space, where it's maybe a smaller venue, or maybe it's not as formal. Film, for example, where you could just turn on a movie and have exposure to classical music or to an opera that's done, you know, without a track, which is just live singing. And like the Met does their film versions that they release here. But right. I'm thinking more an actual film, you know, where you are in it with them and you have close-ups and you have different angles and scenes. And so
let me just get this, because I'm going to paraphrase sometimes. Okay. for listeners. You wanted opera and classical music that could be integrated in the community. Mm-hmm. That wasn't this special thing put on the pedestal. Yeah. For every so often, maybe for a certain group of people.
Yeah.
But more integrated into the life.
Yes.
You know, I've seen those pictures of flash mobs in Europe, you know, that just, they rip your heart, because everybody is out singing along with the classical music, and, you know, tears are coming down their face, and it feels like a piece of ownership, a piece of who they are.
Yes.
But I don't think we have that in general, you know.
Well, for so long, I think maybe since the 1950s, 60s, opera has had the rap of being elitist, has been institutionalized. One needs a theater in which to produce opera, and in this country, when we don't have government subsidized arts, it becomes the job of the private sector and philanthropy to fill that gap. And in Europe and historically, opera has been very much part of the cultural fabric. It has been absolutely subversive and political, to the point where censors in Italy would not let certain subjects go through. In Russia, in Soviet Russia, absolutely not. And you still had composers and librettists, the people who wrote the texts of the opera, put through things that the common people knew, and let's say even the politicians knew, was absolutely directed to current events, politics, social life, and culture. And I think with what we are doing, we would like to keep that going. Some of the shows are not, some of the themes are not pretty, they're not polite, and that's okay. This first production that we're doing was originally written in 1930 by a French playwright named Jean Cocteau, who went on to become one of France's most esteemed filmmakers. He inspired filmmakers of today like Almodóvar and David Lynch. And then 20 years later, he hooked up with one of France's most beloved composers, Francis Poulenc, and they got together to tell this story of how technology impacts interpersonal relationships through the medium of the telephone, which in 1930, it was just starting to become ubiquitous in the home. And what happens when you have a final conversation with somebody, not in person, but over the phone, which in 1930 was just becoming routine, but before that was unheard of. And how does that happen when you take these universal themes of a final conversation and do an individual experience with that? And we have the fortune of not being institutional. I think actually it's a benefit that we decentralize this art form, and we can take it to small places where the venue becomes as much a character as the characters and the roles of the piece. And in this case, we take this piece, same script, same music, and we do six very different interpretations of what that final phone call looks like. And I think going forward, we continue to push with stories about the community, by the community, which was what Lucy was referring to, of really highlighting artists from the region, including composers, librettists, conductors, instrumentalists, and the wealth and the highlight the wealth of talent that we have in this region. So stories about the region by artists in the region.
So you're weaving together a lot of threads, because you have First of all, you have the very interesting storyline and music from Poulenc and Cocteau, which is unusual and strangely relevant.
Absolutely.
You know, you talk about love. Now I can see why you're called the Vox Humain or Vox Humain.
Yeah, the original piece is called La Voix Humaine, the human voice.
Yeah.
And then we're doing a slightly different take on it. So Vox, voice. Yeah. And each version has its own title that is relevant to how our concept of the piece.
Interesting. And but people won't, will people be able to see all six? I mean, can you kind of bop around Seattle and see all six? Or is that going to be?
They could.
They could.
Absolutely. That was part of the plan in the timing is can, if one so desires, can you, starting at 10:30 in the morning, be at South Lake Union and stand out front of this storefront? There will be no seats, by the way. This is a standing room on the sidewalk. Yeah. And see the first interpretation. And then make your way to First Church Seattle for a performance at noon. Take a little break. Make your way to Pike Place Market, where we will be doing one inside the Rabbit Box Theater, which is such a delightful venue, for a kickoff at, doors are at 2, show starts at 3. And finally, having our final live version will be at the Art Love Salon on First and Union, with doors open at 5, performance, you'll just have to find out, sometime after that.
Amazing.
And then 2 streamed versions in between all of those. So people who are at home who may not be able to make it to the different venues or even want to watch while they're on their way to another venue can watch live 2 of the versions that we have filmed.
Great, because you were going to do something on Vashon. It didn't quite work out, but Vashonites can follow you if they don't want to make the trek over to Seattle.
Absolutely. Please do.
Yeah, absolutely. So you are highlighting artists in their community. You're providing different ways to interact with the collective. But in your material, you're also talking about reimagining the art form as a vehicle for equity, accessibility, and transformation. That's a pretty big mandate. Mm. So what does equity, accessibility, what is social change, what does that look like in the context of your work?
Well, I wonder if I could speak a little bit.
I would
that.
Love it.
So
yeah.
With the version that I'm doing, we have the piece set in a church, and the conversation is clearly one that is between a couple of gay lovers who are now separated, and having that conversation happen while one of them is in a sanctuary. Already sparks ideas about the openness to different ways of living. It already opens the window to some thinking about equity and accessibility. The church, for most of us, I think, in growing up, has been kind of central. Certainly it was for me as I grew up and as I was a singer. The church was kind of the first place that I did my singing. So for me, bringing that piece to that space already gives me the ideas about, okay, well, what can this space be, not just for me at this time, but what does this space invoke and remind me of from when I was a little boy? And that's for good or for ill. But I think also in terms of the accessibility piece, one of the things that I remember from years ago with singing in a really cool company in Boston is there was a director that we worked with who said quite directly that we had better get on board with making opera more accessible to more people. Otherwise, we're just going to end up with kind of this museum type atmosphere where nobody but certain people comes because it just doesn't feel like they're able to touch what's happening. And one of the other kind of interesting bits with kind of thinking in terms of accessibility is the composer of this piece, Poulenc, also composed a really, really compelling opera, Dialogue of the Carmelites.
I've watched that. Oh my God, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
I get chills every time I think about it.
I remember seeing it 1 year three times essentially in a row because friends of mine were in it, and it ripped my heart out every single night. But one of the things that I remember about that piece is that Poulenc wanted it translated into other languages. He did not want people in other countries to experience the piece in a way that wouldn't be accessible to them. He wanted it translated. And so often if you see the piece done in English-speaking countries, they do it in English. And so while this is an English adaptation of his work, that also speaks to that accessibility part where it's like, we want to make sure that you really and truly have this experience in a way that speaks to you.
Yeah. I love that.
And I would like to add to what Cortland said, that it's a very thoughtful and intentional adaptation. This was one that we specifically sought and found was done by a Canadian tenor named Isaiah Bell, who had adapted it for an interpretation that he was doing with Vancouver City Opera in 2021, I believe. So it's very fresh. It's very relevant. It is not the translation that you get in a score that was translated in 1935, and there are these and thous, and it's beautifully done. And I think for my ears and eyes, really one of the only translations I've found of this work that fits our 21st century American life.
So interesting. One of the things, I didn't really think this much about the dialogue of the Carmelites, but because it's very historical, it took place in France at a particular historic moment in time, but it's also about speaking truth to power.
Yeah, it is.
And those are big words these days.
Yeah.
You know, do you think about that? And do you have any, we're in a pretty safe space here with Vashon in Seattle, but speaking truth to power is, it's got some risks these days.
I think now more than ever, as an adult who is an artist, I think it's becoming more and more real to me how important it is to create art in times of adversity. And I, you know, growing up in the 80s, I think we didn't really, you know, Gen X, we're just kind of like, oh yeah, we want to be subversive. But I think now, being able to speak about things that communities experience is a way to facilitate conversations. And, you know, we're going to get audiences who aren't always on the same page, who don't agree with each other. And I think when you perform something with honesty and openness, you facilitate those conversations. I think one opera that is my absolute favorite is Dead Man Walking. And I think, you know, Ebi and I have had in-depth conversations about this and about our views as to what kind of conversation you have around that piece. And I know that people aren't always on the same page with the death penalty, but I think in order to have a piece that is performed in a way with respect to that conversation, you're able to bring opposing views together to have a conversation at least, and to open people's minds to what we can address. And I think that's the most important thing about art, is if it's embedded in the community and if people have this desire to go see it and they feel included in it, then they're open to having more and more conversations and people get to know each other on a different level. I mean, The Marriage of Figaro, it's a silly opera, but it deals with some very, very profound things that were happening at that time. But Mozart dealt with it in a silly way. But then if you think about what he was saying, it's very important what he was saying.
Well, there's a reason he chose that piece.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was a French, it was a French play.
Yeah.
And he took it because it created such a stir in France, the upstairs, downstairs aristocracy versus the servant class, and produced it not long before the French Revolution.
Yep.
And how incredible that, you know, the outwitting of the aristocracy by the servant class. Yeah, yep. That was not an accident. And people are still talking about it today, and we still have delightful conversations, but it's absolutely using performance art. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a doctor, but how can I help the people in my community
yeah.
sure.
grow and have hard conversations around topics that we may not want to have or that we don't think are conversations that we should have yep. in polite, you know, rooms. And actually, there are a lot of things that impact us that we need to start talking about.
Yep.
Right.
And well, probably should have been talking about all along.
I think what you're doing is so exciting. I think I've told you that. But I'm also real interested in the arts in times of massive change.
Yeah.
And one of the things I noticed, because back there was a period of time, I was living in South America in the early 70s, when it felt like the music of the people just came out in spades. It was mm-hmm. like here in the end of the 60s. And somehow we were giving voice to what we felt, and songwriters were. And I felt like the music carried us through a whole period of time. And I don't quite have the same feeling these days that there is a music that is carrying us. Maybe it'll arise and stuff. So I think there's really something special when you have music and beauty and engagement, and they're all coming together. So wherever you enter, if for your love of music, you know, for the little bit of humor that might be in Figaro, you have an entrance mm-hmm. into a conversation that might be difficult to have without the aesthetic, without the beauty, without the music, without the interesting stuff. What do you think about that?
That puts me in the mind of an opera that I was really honored to be a part of at Seattle Opera, a newer production called Blue. And Blue's setting was in New York with a Black mother and father, the father being a policeman. And they have a child. And that child is a son. And that son begins to grow up and to experience the world during the time of upheaval, protests over George Floyd, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was really a very timely production. It was a great time after CHOP and all of that to have the beginnings of that conversation. And I think one of the things that I still feel a little sideways about is that we weren't able to sort of make an en masse reach out to SPD to be able to say, come see this show. It may have
Seattle Police Department.
It may do that. And some of that resonance might not be great, but it's a part of giving ourselves a chance to have the conversation about what public safety looks like and what it's for and who it's for, and how the way that we do policing in our country still affects people. Mm-hmm. And so I really try to think in those terms about what I do as an artist is to bring as much of my full self to whatever piece that I'm working through.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you have interaction with the audiences after your performances?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody leads a discussion or a...
After every performance in this one, there will not be... There's just not time... either the venues or between the shows to facilitate a full panel discussion. That is the goal for the future iterations. But there will be two opportunities this time, both after the performance at the Rabbit Box and the one at the Art Love Gallery. These will be more informal discussions with myself and the artists and anybody who has... It's more like a Q&A mm-hmm. between the audience and the creators of the work. And I think facilitating dialogue immediately when these ideas are fresh, or why are you doing this? Why didn't you do this? What, I didn't really get this, or I have a strong opinion about this, is a great way to bring people in and further these conversations that both Lucy and Corland were talking about, as well as working with community organizations that are not in the arts sector. And bringing in these other arts leaders and community leaders to bring their communities. You made a really important point that what an incredible opportunity it would have been for the production of Blue to have had a Seattle PD night, to have had and facilitate a dialogue. It may have seemed fresh and difficult to facilitate, but what an incredible opportunity that would have been, because it is such a pressing issue.
Yeah.
And that's something that on a micro scale we are wanting to do with this organization, is it's not performative performance, but it's performance as a means of fostering and nurturing dialogue between all of our neighbors.
Mm-hmm. That when you can, you drop the fourth wall.
Yep.
That stands between the performers and the audience. It exists for a while, but then you roll it back so that people can talk to each other as people.
Yeah? That's right.
Mm. I think we're so disconnected from each other right now. We're just in our phones, you know? And I feel like performance and live theater is one of those ways that people are not able to be in their phone for that moment in time. And they're fully experiencing something. You know, they can't disconnect. I mean, because it's rude. But also, you're invested in it. And I think that when you have that ability to get people in a space and they're not connected to their phone and they're sharing that experience with others, that is when you can start having those conversations and building those communities, I think.
It's a little ironic.
I know.
It's a little ironic that this is the piece we're doing when we talk about keeping people out of their phones, because that's exactly what's happening in the piece, is that this is a conversation that's going on for all intents and purposes electronically. And it's the only way these two people can talk. It's the only way that they can have this last conversation. And quite frankly, that's been a lot of people's lives since the pandemic.
Absolutely. Yes.
You know, we started being really separated then. And so it's kind of an interesting thing to put that up in front of people again and to say, remember when we had to do it this way. And I don't know, maybe we can start thinking about some new ways to live.
I'm speaking today with members of the Rising Water Collective, Waters Collective, and we're talking about this exciting area of bringing classical chamber singing to the community in a way that's engaging and a way that can foster dialogue and hopefully lead to inclusion and social change. Where are you going? I mean, the possibilities seem huge for this kind of work. The expense of pulling it off is probably also huge. How? What do you see on the horizon? What's your dream there? Where might you be going?
We have three seasons mapped out, and we have applied for grants. Let's keep our fingers crossed that they come through, because that will help facilitate the ability to make this art. But it really does rely upon the generosity and the belief of our community in this type of work. So we also will continue to have fundraisers. Where do we see it going? Each season ramps up just a little bit. This is our inaugural production. It is very decentralized, very outside the box. We end the season with a North American premiere of a Catalan opera about gentrification and the impact of gentrification on individual identity, relationships, interpersonal relationships, cultural identity. And we are performing that. We have a partnership with Theater Off Jackson, which is in the Central District, which has seen massive shift in both their Black and Central South American residents in the last 15, 20 years. And to facilitate that conversation with organizations that work specifically with people who are impacted by the gentrification of Seattle I'm very excited about that opportunity. Going forward,
When will that be?
That will be in August of 2026.
Great.
Yes, I'm really excited. And we have future seasons dealing with Voices of the Unheard, going toward children and adolescents, and then a season of justice, both in when you were speaking, Sally, about big conversations and right now things that feel like maybe you shouldn't say them. We are doing one opera that is an intimate chamber opera about the role of the state and the mechanism by which the state executes people. It is based off of a Franz Kafka short story called The Penal Colony in the Penal Colony, and was made into an opera by Philip Glass. It actually premiered at ACT Theater in 2000. So we would like to resurrect that and begin that conversation, and then ending the season, hopefully, with a concert version of Dead Man Walking to facilitate dialogue on forgiveness, faith, redemption, and the impact of violent crime on families, individuals. Again, going back to identity, community identity, family identity, individual identity, and the role of justice in our nation, in our communities, and globally.
I get chills. Mm-hmm. This is really exciting. Do you have a composer on staff? Do you ever think about bringing in somebody to...
We actually have been so lucky that there are some regional composers that we have been talking to. And we've had these little launch concerts that we've done on Vashon, and we've been able to perform the works of two or three regional composers. And, what was her name? The Verilona Heimat. There is an opera that was written by a composer who lives down in Olympia about her mother-in-law, who, when she was a little girl, they lived during World War II in Eastern Europe, and there was a young Jewish girl that came to live with them. And this whole opera was written about her mother-in-law's experience with this young girl and how their family helped keep her safe. And it's a beautiful opera, and it was premiered at Cleveland Opera, I think. And the way she composed it, she wove together traditional folk songs, and it is just so lovely and lyrical. And we've had meetings with Sheila Silver, who wrote Under a Thousand Splendid Suns. She has written an art song cycle, and I was able to sing some of those songs. It's so important to us to be able to work with our regional composers. I really think that opera is a living art form. It's existing, it's moving forward, and there are so many talented composers and librettists who live here. And I have been fortunate enough to sing with Seattle Opera in their school tour. It's a lot of fun. And we often perform brand new works by younger composers. And there is a composer who was our touring accompanist, Stephen Luxon. And he is a delight. Anyway, so we've been talking to him. He's written a beautiful opera about dealing with aging parents and what that looks like. And so we've been talking to him. And it's just... It's so exciting to be able to have these relationships with regional composers and librettists, because I think hopefully eventually in the future it would be great to have seasons where we premiere or we are able to perform one of their works.
Right. So the Verlorene Heimat was written by Don Sontag.
Don Sontag, yeah.
Incredible piece, incredible story, both historically and its contemporary relevance. And then to commission a new work takes time and takes money. So that is also something we are hoping to be able to do with grant funding and foundation support.
Yeah, because I assume that you kind of have to have a day job or some ways to bring in, mm-hmm. you working with the Seattle Opera or other venues to, you're not going to live on this for a little bit.
No.
Yeah, no, but it is so. And how can Vashon support you? Because this round, we won't be able to hear you except streaming or if people get up and go into Seattle. But what do you see about the relationship with the Vashon community? What's your dream there?
Well, it would be great if we could have it. When EB and I had these conversations, we really wanted an opera company that served the singers from Tacoma up to Bellingham. And it's really important for us to be mobile and to be small and to not be limited by space. And so our ideas are, if we're doing a concert or if we're doing a performance, we find areas that we partner with to perform there. And event, we would love to do a performance of a show on Vashon and to partner with an organization on Vashon where the community is included. I think it's really important for us, for every location we do it, that wherever we're performing, the community is involved in some way. We're hoping, you know, for Bellingham, it would be great if one of our operas is the Child in the Wild Magic. We're hoping. And there's a circus school up in Bellingham.
Yeah.
And it would be great to have that school with the singers and with our professional singers partner together and, you know, have that relationship where the community is invited and is included in that whole production.
On the Vox project, we have been fortunate to speak with and work with the Dove Project, which is based here on Vashon, and they support victims of domestic abuse, which is interwoven into one of the iterations of the L'Avoir Humain, the one that takes place at the storefront in South Lake Union.
Interesting.
For me, it helps to have that as a dramaturgical anchor to make sure that whatever I am doing as a director is rooted outside of my own personal experience, and that I make sure that, okay, is this interpretation representative of a wider body of experiences? So to partner with outside organizations, including here on Vashon Opera, has been, or Vashon, excuse me, on Vashon, has been really important. We filmed one version here on Vashon. We filmed another version in Bellingham to do sort of what Lucy is saying, to make sure that the region is represented. What can Vashon folk do? Well, they can attend our performances. They can support and absolutely reach out with ideas of topics that they want to see addressed and how they feel what we are bringing forward resonates with them, and if they would like to facilitate a panel discussion or a conversation here on the island.
So great. You made a little slip of tongue, but I assume that there's no quote competition between you and the Vashon Opera, because you're so different.
Very different.
You are. It's completely
different. Yeah. And I love Vashon Opera, and what they do and what we're doing is completely different.
Yeah, it's great to underscore that this isn't a counter movement. It's a both and, mm-hmm. you know,
absolutely.
It's an enrichment.
Well, I think what's important is that, you know, anything to give the singers an opportunity, right? This is a whole, the arts are an economy in and of themselves. We have set builders, we have costume designers, we have makeup artists, we have admin. I mean, every company provides work. And I think it's really important that the more companies that diversify that work is better.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it's absolutely great. And there's so much space for all different kinds of this one medium that we call opera is actually so many different things.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just in this conversation alone, you're expanding me, because I'm going, you know, there's a certain dustiness that one often associates with opera because it's Italian sometime a long time ago,
sure.
with people who are not always directly representational of our world, you know.
Sure.
So you get quite this distance. Yes, it's beautiful and it's fun to see, but it's out there. But it's kind of yummy to have you bring it into our world and have more fluid boundaries so that people will be able to interact. And I'm on board.
Yeah.
I'm only disappointed that it won't be here on the 11th,
oh, yeah.
but, you know, yeah. So why don't we hold there? If people want to find out about you, they can go to the Rising Waters Collective website, which I encourage, and I'll put that in the show notes
as well.
And I think it's such a great project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you for taking time out of your schedules, because this is, it's getting down to the line here for the big event.
Yeah, and I hope your audience gets a chance to see Lucy and Corland live. Lucy will be at the Rabbit Box. Mm-hmm. Corland will be at First Church. And you can find out about
Fantastic.
All of that on our website as well.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to being back soon and bringing you another conversation with an island creative who can show you how it's possible to embrace your muse and live your richest and most creative life. Till then, thanks for joining us, and thanks to Voice of Vashon, 101.9 FM, for hosting this show.
I'm your host, Sally Fox, and I look forward to being with you soon.